influenced you to make that decision to study medicine?
Well, I'm sure it was partly growing up as the son of a doctor, and my two uncles, Dad's brothers, were also country GPs in rural South Australia and Victoria. And in fact, their father and his brother were both doctors in the Riverland in Renmark. Yeah, third generation for me, and I'm the last of the line. So,
oh, right.
Yeah, the only one, and doesn't look like there's going to be any more. So I got married in 1990 to a girl, Fiona, that I'd met at medical school. And so we both decided we'd come over to the UK in 1991, and we worked at Warwick Hospital, again, partly because Dad had been in that area and some of Mum's relatives were still around that area. So I spent a year in Warwick doing my first year of anaesthesia and ICU as an SHO at Warwick Hospital. But after about 6 or 8 months in the UK, I really felt strongly that I wanted to be an anaesthetist and applied to the training program back in Australia and was lucky to get a spot there.
Was there anybody in Warwick that particularly influenced you?
Well, I was very impressed with a number of the consultants there. David Tweedy was the chap who was the consultant, the boss there, and I haven't really kept in touch with any of them, to be honest.
You telling me you did your first appendix after a couple of weeks.
So on a Saturday night, and we were doing the whole weekend on call and finishing at Monday lunchtime, so it was truly exhausting, and I hope that's still not the case in the NHS. It's certainly not at home anymore. You know, the training here at that time seemed to really revolve around bringing you up to a level of independence and self-sufficiency very rapidly with that diploma of anaesthesia, the part one that I did at that stage. And, you know, when you're in theatre with the consultants doing elective lists, it was just constantly, you know, failed intubation drill, what are you going to do? Anaphylaxis, what are you going
to
do?
And then you went back to Australia, back to Adelaide.
Yep, back to Australia to start the anaesthetics training program. It was very competitive to get into anaesthesia, so I think having a year of, you know, that sort of practical anaesthesia and ICU under your belt put me in really good stead because they wanted guys who could hit the ground running. So a guy called Bill Fuller was the consultant, the boss at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Adelaide. I think he put in a vote for me and got me a job in the training program.
And then you did all your training in Adelaide, did you?
Yeah, so Adelaide then and still, I think, has a really good training program.
You did a little bit of training in New Zealand, I believe.
So yes, at the end of after I'd got my fellowship and was just looking for one more year to sort of round me off, I actually thought back to Warwick and how much I enjoyed being in a good general hospital. And so I found this job in New Zealand in Northland, in a town called Whangarei, which is a couple of hours north of Auckland. And again, just a great general hospital. I did half ICU and half anaesthesia, lots of neonates and kids, which I enjoy doing, and a little bit of helicopter retrieval work around the North Island as well. And I'd done some retrieval work also at the Royal Adelaide Hospital and the Children's Hospital in Adelaide when I was a registrar. So I was already getting a bit of a taste for that aeromedical work. So that was a great year and didn't do any harm that there is wonderful diving and fishing in the northern part of New Zealand. It's mm-hmm. truly spectacular up there. So that probably influenced my selection of hospital as well. Yeah, so I went straight back to private practice and was a visiting specialist at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. I was trying to pursue an interest in vascular anaesthesia, which was the thing I was really had my heart set on at that stage. So I was working a day a week at the Queen Elizabeth trying to, you know, get a foot in the door in vascular. So after a few years of that, I decided to step away from that and started work at the Royal Adelaide Hospital doing diving and hyperbaric medicine for my one day a week outside of my private practice, which was great. I did that for 12 years another degree in, or, you know, a certificate in diving and hyperbaric medicine, which again obviously ties in well with my passion for recreational diving, but I enjoyed that. Yeah, so now I'm half and half between private practice anaesthesia and working for MedStar, which is the aeromedical retrieval arm of the South Australian Ambulance Service. Anaesthesia is fortunately perhaps a slightly slower changing specialty, so it's a bit easier to keep up with significant advances, I find.
And probably gives you a bit more flexibility to to do your diving.
Well, it has been very good for me to be able to follow my passion for diving and exploration and the expeditions that I get involved with, which does take me away from home for quite a few weeks a year. There's actually a family friend who owned a dive shop in Adelaide, a very famous South Australian personality called David Birchall, who lost his one of his legs in a train accident as a teenager. And despite that, he went on to be an incredible athlete. He was a gymnast and could do all these amazing tricks and, you know, flips. And he was a scuba diver and one of the very first scuba divers in Australia, really, who started to do it recreationally. And then he got involved with the police divers and was training them. And he set up this dive shop in Adelaide called Adelaide Skin Diving Centre. Finally, I did my diving course when I was about 15 years old there. And then I'd pop in after school and go and test gear in the tank. I'm really immersed in it, literally, you know, very early on. And it was always been a big part of my life. Doing that in 1985 when I was still at university. I was part of the Flinders University Dive Club and a few of us became divers. Well, we're getting a little bit bored with these dives off Adelaide. Why don't we do something different? And we heard about these caves down south of Adelaide, an area called Mount Gambier, which is quite well known for freshwater sinkholes and caves. So we went down there and did a course, and actually it was middle of winter, and the cave, the water's about 14 degrees, and I was wearing a cheap wetsuit, and it was pretty miserable, to be honest. I didn't really like it. So I went away from it for quite. Just happened to be down in the area and went for a bit of a dive in one of those sinkholes, and just absolutely fell in love with it again. So
at some stage you got involved in MedStar, the South Australian Ambulance Service group. When was that?
Yeah, so I went back to them in 2012 after retrieval has sort of evolved quite a lot in South Australia over many years, but it basically used to be based in the intensive care units, and I worked there as a registrar, but then didn't do much until I decided to go back to it in 2012, and by then MedStar had just been formed a couple of years before that.
And you're now the head of coordination.
Yeah, so coordination is a big part of, you know, the retrieval service. Going through those steps I've just mentioned, and I'm currently the head of the unit of for retrieval coordination, which basically means I'm in charge of the consultant group and all the logistical sort of stuff. I guess it's like an operational lead.
Impressive cave dives, I think. One I was reading about in 2011, you tried to find the source of the Pearce River, is that right?
The Pearce, yeah, Pearce Resurgence. So that's kind of been the signature project for our little group of divers. We're just a bunch of mates, really. I first went there in 2007 with some guys who had been exploring it for a few years, and they had explored it down to a depth of 125 metres. And actually on that trip is when I first met Rick Stanton, who's the British cave diver who was in Thailand, who called me out. And Rick is an astonishing guy. I don't think anyone would disagree in the caving community worldwide that he is the kind of the leader. And he's just on the cusp of it. In fact, he keeps trying to retire, but he keeps getting called out for all these sort of jobs. But Rick is an extraordinarily pragmatic, intelligent, sensible guy who has just done these exceptional things worldwide in cave exploration. So Rick came and from 125 metres, Rick, using this funny old homemade rebreather that he'd built out of bits of PVC and so forth, he dived down to 177 metres in this cave, which just, you know, nearly doubled. And then after that, been going back almost every year with a slightly bigger team, and myself and Craig Challen, the chap I took over to Thailand with me. The vet, retired vet now, he happily says. We've now pushed that cave down to 230 metres in depth and quite a significant horizontal distance as well. So it's become a very complex logistical exercise. I find the physiology of deep diving really fascinating because there's all sorts of issues that arise in terms of gas density and gas toxicities and things that don't really become apparent until you're at about 150 metres. So beyond that depth, you're starting to really push the envelope in terms of safety and what you can do. For me, it's been a real exercise in logistics and safety and working out a way to do this very slowly, which is why we've taken so long to get so far, I guess.
Rick Stanton, he's an Englishman. He's up in the north somewhere, isn't he?
Yeah, he lives in Coventry, and he's a firefighter, also just retired. So 12 boys and their coach from the Wild Boars soccer team in Chiang Rai province, which is the most northern province in Thailand. Basically, on a Saturday afternoon after soccer training, I think it was one of the kids' birthdays, so they said, let's go for a bit of an adventure into the cave. We'll just go in for an hour and then come back out in time for the birthday party for one of the boys. And some of them had been in the cave before. I mean, this was their backyard. It's a local, you know, place to go and have an adventure. And there's a sign up outside the cave saying, you know, danger, do not enter the cave from July to November, I think it is, because of the monsoon season and the risk of flooding of the cave. This was June the 23rd, so they were just inside that window, and, you know, it was a bit unfair, really, that the rains had already started up in the mountains when they entered, and that they, you know, there was a big monsoonal downpour after they entered, and so the cave flooded while they were inside, and they were trapped about 2.5 kilometres into the cave. Back, they were walking back out and then suddenly realised they were walking in water when it wasn't wet before. And then suddenly they got to this point where the water met the ceiling and they realised they were trapped. And the coach, to his credit, tried to dive through that, attached to a piece of rope, and couldn't, you know, ran out of breath and had to turn around, and the kids pulled him back in. So at that stage, I think the water was still rising, so they had to retreat into the cave to find higher ground, and finally found this muddy embankment, very steep slope, where they huddled up the top of that about 15 metres above the water. So they were at a pretty good safety margin at that point. Lives in Thailand, who's a caver, who recognised that the rescue wasn't proceeding, and in fact the search wasn't even proceeding at that stage, and that they clearly needed some cave divers to come over and help push further into the cave to try and find the kids. I said, okay, we'll authorise these three guys to come over from England. So they got flown over fairly early on in the piece, and at that stage the cave was still flooding, still the water levels going up, and it was extremely hazardous environment at that stage. In fact, when they arrived, they couldn't even get into the cave because of the volume of water coming out of it. Well, we got called. I'd been in communication with Rick Stanton and another diver from Belgium who were on site, and just talking through the problems and the options. And as you can imagine, it was fairly chaotic because really no one knew exactly what to do.
You had a language problem as well.
It was the language problem, and this was a completely unprecedented event worldwide. No one had ever thought about how to deal with something like this. You know, there'd been the two miners trapped in South America a couple of years before that, when they drilled a little borehole down to the mine and then put in that bigger hole and then brought them out with that cage. But the problem here was that the map of the cave wasn't accurate enough to know how to drill down from the surface to the exact spot where they thought the kids were. And the water was still flooding out of the cave. No one could get in there to safely even look for the kids, really. So when the British cave divers arrived, there was a great sense of doom and dread, I think, that, you know, the kids were almost certainly dead inside the cave, but they had to start searching. Eventually they did push their way into the cave and lay a rope through the cave, which was an enormously difficult task to lay thick rope throughout the cave into the face of flooding water.
And the Thai divers did that?
No, the British divers did that. Rick and John. And that, in my opinion, was the single greatest diving achievement of that rescue.
And John was still doing that when he came across them?
Yeah, so they both surfaced in that chamber where the kids were. And their technique was to surface in each air bell and take their mask off, call out, and also sniff the air to see if they could smell any, you know, hint of human presence. And on this last time they surfaced in the chamber, they were actually at the end of their line, so they had run out of rope for that day, so they would have had to stop there anyway and go back and come back the next day with more rope. And they put their heads out and smelt the air and immediately knew there was either living people and a lot of excrement and waste in there, or dead bodies. And they were still expecting really to find bodies at this stage, so pretty tough psychologically for those guys. Anyway, they called out and suddenly heard a commotion and an answer. And so they swam around the corner, and there's all these kids sitting on the mud. But once they did find the kids, then, of course, the next thing is how to get them out, because the chances are the monsoons are about to really start properly, in which case it'll return to that fully flooded situation where they won't be able to even get into the cave to supply the kids with food or contact them again.
And presumably the ledge the kids were on would have been flooded then.
Well, we'll never really know the answer to that. It was pretty high, but yeah, you wouldn't want to put it to the... I was in the operating theatre actually doing a thyroid, I remember, and I've been exchanging messages with Rick on the phone. And he actually rang me up and said, look, we're a bit stuck here. We've actually got no way of getting these kids out. The monsoon's going to start again any minute. There's been a lot of attempts to lower the water levels with pumping, and it might be controlling the water level, but it's certainly not lowering it. They're trying to find an entrance from the top of the mountains, but the feeling from the geologists is that there won't be a connection. They're trying to drill down from the surface, but they've got no way of knowing where they are in relation to the cave, so it will be a one in a million if they manage to find a way down with a drill. So we need to get these kids out, and the only thing I can think of is to sedate them. Would you be prepared to come over and do that? And my immediate response was absolutely not. I can't think of a more certain way to sentence these kids to death and give them an anaesthetic and then try and bring them out underwater 2.5 kilometres. But I did say I'd be happy to come over and help, and maybe I can swim in and give the kids some medical support while we're waiting to work out what the plan is or whatever. Divers, and had a meeting with them and just confirmed all the stuff that I've kind of talked to you about, that things were pretty dire and there was no immediate plan to rescue the kids. No one knew how to go about it. So we talked through this idea of sedation, and I talked to some of the Thai medical specialists on site about that, and they wanted to know what I was thinking. And I don't know if you've ever tried to convince someone else of a plan that you have no faith in yourself, but that's what I felt like I was doing. But anyway, I said, look, I can't even think about rescuing the kids until I've managed to swim in there myself and have a look at the kids and make sure I'm safe in the cave and that I can physically get to the end of the cave and back without, endangering my own life. And so the next day, Craig and I left about 10 a.m. to enter the cave. Managed to get to the end of the cave in about 3 or 4 hours. It was fairly hard going, but not the worst we'd done. So at least I was confident that I could do the dive.
Was there much of a current?
Yeah, it was still quite a strong flow, so you had to pull yourself hand over hand along the rope for, 2.5 kilometres. So it was a pretty big day out.
Was it harder getting in or getting out?
Much harder going in, yeah. Easy going out, although you have to be careful not to lose the rope on the way out, because as you come out, all the silt and mud is following you out, so it's really zero visibility. So it's just hand on the rope and let yourself get floated along by the current.
But it wasn't the most difficult cave diving you've done.
It wasn't the most difficult. I mean, it was pretty sporting. There are a couple of these sumps, which are the underwater sections, where they're very restrictive passages, so you had to feel your way around to find the bit of cave that you could fit through. They did very well.
So you got there in 3 hours, and did you take any equipment with you?
We took some food. Initially, we thought we'll take some food for ourselves, but of course, once we got there and started talking to the kids, well, immediately we just... gave them the food and they wolfed that down.
And did you do any sort of medical assessment with the kids?
Yeah, there were four Thai divers in there with the kids. They'd gone in there quite early on and they'd been pretty much stuck there since because they'd used up all their air, so they couldn't escape themselves at that stage.
One of them was a doctor.
And one of them was a doctor. So through Dr. Puck, who spoke quite reasonable English, I just asked about, did a bit of a systematic review of the kids. I could hear a couple of them coughing in the background, so I think some of them had early chest infections. But apart from that, apart from a few little cuts and scrapes on their legs and things, they were all in really good shape, all standing up, walking around. They'd had a bit of food brought into them by then, so they were sort of bouncing back a bit from the weakness of 9 days starvation.
And they'd been able to drink. Not much sleep, I suppose.
No, they were asleep for an hour and then wake up, sleep for an hour and then wake up. They were chilled to the bone the whole time and losing weight because of that and the lack of food.
Age range was?
So the youngest was 11 and the oldest was 16 and the coach was 25. and ranged from 29 kilos up to about 65.
So, but you didn't know their weights.
We did. So I was given a list of their weights before the first rescue day by one of the local doctors, and they must have got that from the parents, perhaps. But then I actually asked each kid as they, through Dr. Puck, the interpreter, I asked each kid for their weight as they came down for their little anaesthetic, and the weight seemed to correlate pretty well, with the exception of one that we were caught out with, the last kid who we thought we'd gotten done all the small kids, and then the last kid turned out to be the lightest, the 29-kilo boy. So that was a bit of a problem, actually, because the face mask that we had for him wasn't the right one.
Having done that assessment, you then went back the first day, didn't
you? Yeah, so we spent a bit of time. We did some video of them for their parents because, you know, every day we left, there was a distinct possibility the rain would start and we wouldn't get back in. So there was a chance every day we saw them that we'd be swimming out never to see them again and they'd be left to die. So I got some video of them and we got them all to write a note for their parents to take out as well. But told them through Dr. Puck that we would be coming back the next day and that this would be the plan, and that, you know, they were going to... I asked them to fast six of the kids from 6 a.m, thinking we'll be in at about midday for them.
So you had made up the decision that, yes, you were going to sedate them. When, yeah, did you change your mind from saying no way to,
well,
this is the only...
Really, it was during that day. I think it was probably that morning that Craig and I did our first dive, that after, you know, a night of meetings and discussions with the British divers and all the Thai rescue authorities, it really seemed like there was no other option for bringing the kids out unless they were sedated. We talked about every conceivable plan, you know, teaching them to dive, just restraining them somehow so that if they panicked they wouldn't thrash around and endanger the lives of the divers. But really, it would be too cruel to inflict that on the kids without having at least some sedation on board. So of course the next question was, what drugs were we going to use? And you know, I spoke to a friend of mine in Australia.
This is the guy who'd given ketamine to a seal.
Yeah, so this guy is a very practical fellow who I have enormous respect for. He works at the retrieval service. We decided that sounded like the best drug. But of course there's really no alternative in terms of if you want to maintain an airway, respiration and some sort of blood pressure, there really isn't any other choice.
And what sort of, how did you decide on the dose then?
Well, whilst I had given a large amount of ketamine over the years, particularly when I spent 2 years working in Vanuatu, which is something I didn't mention, but I spent 2 years over there, so I was very comfortable giving ketamine anaesthetics. But what I hadn't really done much of, if any, was intramuscular ketamine. So, you know, with the idea that keeping things as simple as possible would be sensible, I decided it would be intramuscular ketamine given through the wetsuit into the thigh, and based it on 5 milligrams per kilo as a, you know, a good starting dose, and then a half dose thereafter of 2.5 milligrams per kilo if the kids needed topping up on the way out.
Which they did,
yeah, at least twice and often up to 4 times on the way out. We had about, it was about 12 or 14 of us in the end who were able to go into the cave and help with the rescue. So basically I remember giving this anaesthetic lecture to them on the morning of the first rescue day, and I had to again convince these guys of a plan that I had very little faith in and try and assure them that it was an inherently safe technique and there was nothing for them to worry about. They all practiced giving an intramuscular injection into a water bottle. That was their one. Seemed to work pretty well.
And they knew the weights of each child coming through, did they? Or the dose?
No. So to keep, again, to make it as simple as possible and to try and avoid errors, what I did was divide the kids into, and remembering that they were basically between 30 and 60, I decided to call them all either 40 or 50 kilo kids. And then... So the divers were given bags of drugs labelled big kid, small kid, top up. That was seemed to me the safest way to do it in the hands of, you know, lay people. I had to just eliminate all the decision points that I could, so they would have the confidence just to do something rather than do nothing, I guess.
About
2:30 in the morning, I think, after being in the cave for 12 hours. Got about 2 hours sleep and then back into it the next day.
With the ketamine?
with the ketamine.
And some anxiolytic as well.
So yeah, so I gave each kid a tablet of alprazolam, tried to get that into them about half an hour before their turn. And the idea behind that was A, just to give them a bit of anxiolysis before they came down the slope. Of course, I forgot about the fact that they'd be a bit drugged while they're walking down this steep, muddy slope. They're all a bit wobbly, but they all seemed to be all right.
And they were starved, were they?
Yeah, I got them to be fasted from 6 a.m. for a roughly midday start. And I gave them a dose of IM atropine into one leg and then IM ketamine into the other leg. The two biggest concerns I had was that as a diver, you're constantly, and unconsciously once you're experienced, you're constantly removing water from the mask, even with these full face masks that we sometimes use for filming and other reasons when you might need communications, for example. So I just thought that inevitably at some point the mask will get water in it and the child will drown inside the mask. Also knowing that the number of times we were banging our own head in this low visibility water on the pendants and stalactites that, you know, coming down from the ceiling, you'd often smack your head into them as you're leaving or swimming through the cave. I thought at some point the mask will get bumped and dislodged and will fill up with water, so that was my first concern. I thought even if they don't drown, surely their head will fall forward and they'll obstruct their airway at some point, and these divers, not being anaesthetists, won't, you know, despite me trying to tell them to make sure they just try and hold the chin up where possible, you know, at some point they'll obstruct their airway. And if that didn't kill them, then I thought, well, they'll probably die of hypothermia because the water's only about 20. And if they're going to be...
They were cold when they started.
They're already cold, they're skinny, they're in badly fitting wetsuits, and they're going to be immersed under anaesthesia for 3 hours. I mean... So the masks, we sorted through lots of different brands, and there were literally hundreds of these face masks sent from all over the world for us to look at and try. We ended up with one specific one which seemed to fit the kids. We tested it on some local kids and also had positive pressure in it. So a bit like firemen using in smoke-filled scenes or where there's toxins or poisons in the air, positive pressure to make sure nothing comes in, including water.
And was that oxygen or air? Or?
So we wanted to use 100% oxygen, and the theory for that was that, like with any anaesthetic, if they're hypoventilating, that will help maintain their oxygenation. Also, given that the kids are probably all getting chest infections, that would be a good thing. But also, if a kid did drown and had 100% oxygen on board, then it might prolong the time to successful resuscitation if that was possible. So I thought it might just give us a little extra safety margin there if one of them did drown, and you could race them through to the next dry chamber and improve the chance of six resuscitation. One diver per child, taking responsibility all the way through, and that will station some other divers along the cave to assist them in the dry sections or the drier sections. And the other divers can help top up the anaesthetic and give the main diver a little mental rest at least for a few minutes while they're moving through that canal or drier section. Yeah, we fasted six kids on the first morning, but then it became clear that actually we only had four face masks which were suitable. So two of the kids were a bit disappointed on the first day, that only four were going to go out. Each child was dressed in a wetsuit, full face mask, a scuba cylinder strapped to their front, which would make them float in the prone position.
Like a sort of keel.
Yeah, yeah. It had a buoyancy collar around them so the diver could inflate that with a little bit of air and just get them neutrally buoyant in the water so it would make them much easier to handle as they were pushed out of the cave. And so I would anaesthetise the child, they'd come down to the water, sit on my lap, I'd give them the anaesthetic. Once they were asleep, which was surprisingly quick, actually 5 minutes, then you put the full face mask on them. I'd tested it a couple of times under the water to make sure it wasn't leaking and they were breathing adequately. And then the British diver would set off with them and take them out.
And each of them had roughly three top-ups, did they? Two or three?
Yeah, I think it worked out between two and four. I did lose track a little bit of exactly how much. But rather than getting into the subtle signs of ketamine anaesthesia, I just told the guys, look, if you think they're waking up, just give them another dose because it's very hard to overdose them. And my priority was that the divers weren't endangered. But I think sometimes the kids were given ketamine probably a bit early just because their eyes were open and they were talking a little bit or moaning. But didn't seem to cause any great problems. On that first day, we set up a system where one of the British divers would swim in from the chamber 8, which was the next chamber down, would swim back in to let me know that the first one or two kids had got through at least that first dive successfully. And so that did happen, and you know, gave me the courage to go on.
I don't know what I want to ask you. What you would have done if it?
Well, I actually don't know what I would. I had said to all the divers, look, if the first couple of kids don't survive that first dive, I don't think I can keep doing this. So I'm glad it didn't come to that, because if we'd left those kids, they would have died. There's no question in my mind. So I suspect we would have had to go back the next day and try and change something with our technique and just try again.
Anyway, you got out and you found that the first four had survived.
Yeah.
You must have been fairly pleased about that.
I was, but you know what? I was more frightened that night than I was before the first day, because I felt it was so unlikely that this was going to work, that I just had this terrible sense of dread that even though the first four had got out alive, surely the next day they would all die. I couldn't believe it was going to work, honestly. It just seemed such a outrageously dangerous thing to be doing to these kids. So we repeated the same thing essentially the next day, and that was successful. And then the third day, of course, we had five people to bring out, so we had to decide whether we were going to try for five in one go or leave one behind and do a fourth day. Now every day it had been raining, and the pumps were only just sort of holding back the water, and they were very nervous on the third day. They're very experienced in those sorts of caves, and Rick in particular said, I've just, you know, it's been raining and I reckon, you know, this cave's going to flood any minute basically. So we decided on that third day that there were some measuring sticks throughout the cave. We decided that if the cave even went up 1 centimetre, we were going to turn around and come out, because the risk of a flood pulse coming through the cave was so high. But we decided we were going to try for all five. But we only had four of the really good masks, so we took two other masks with us. One different commercial diving mask, which did have positive pressure, but it was really large. And one small, very recreational mask, which wasn't positive pressure and really looked like a bit of a toy. It was, you know, a bit of a gimmicky sort of a thing, but it was much smaller. So we did the first four kids, and including the coach, because he just... And then the last kid came down, and we had the very big mask and the tiny toy mask, and he was 29 kilos. He was the smallest of all. And I thought we'd done all the smaller kids, and then this tiny little thing comes down the mud slope, and I'm like, bloody hell, this mask aren't going to fit this guy. And sure enough, gave him the anaesthetic, and then tried the big commercial diving mask on, and you could put your hand down the side of it. It was just no way. So we had to make this little plastic pink toy thing fit. And, you know, it was really soft, and it didn't seem to be sitting properly. And
with no positive pressure?
No positive pressure. We fiddled around with it for about half an hour, me and Jason, one of the British guys. And I said in the end, well, we're either going to wake him up again and come back tomorrow, or we just go. So we decided to risk it and send him out. I said to the Thai guys, look, give us 2 hours to go, and then you guys follow, because the last child, yeah, I basically put my gear on and followed out. And I was just about all the way out to the entrance when I came across one of the British divers in one of the canals all by himself just before the last dive, which was actually the most difficult dive. And he looked as white as a sheet, and he seemed very pleased to see me. And I said, oh, is everything all right? Is the kid all right? And he said, yeah, the kid's fine. It's me. I've had a bit of a near miss. And he had, as he was diving through that last sump with the child, he had lost the line and swam around for about 15 minutes lost in this pitch black water, unable to see anything. And finally ended up coming back into the cave, into the, you know, the opposite direction, turned himself around. And the kid was starting to wake up, and, you know, he was in a real state. He starts the child. I said, you sit here and just take some time to get your stuff back together, and then I'll take the kid out. So that was the only time I'd actually taken one of the kids underwater, and I'd chosen the worst, you know, sump to do it through. In the process of not losing the kid and not losing the rope, I lost the rope in exactly the same spot that this other guy had done, but it took me about 3 minutes to find it again. But boy, it gives you gives you a fright. So I stuck my head up out of the water, and there's immediately surrounded by the US Air Force guys, the pararescue team, who are amazing blokes, and they're all paramedics, very highly trained special forces medics. So they just whisk the kid away and take him out the last 500 metres of dry cave. And they're all, you know, slapping me on the back, saying, "Well done, Doc, that's it, all done. They're all out, they're all alive." We still really had no concept of the global size of the story until I got home, I think, and there's reporters everywhere. In the sense that there was a story, but I didn't realise how big... Yeah, I mean, for the British divers, obviously the story was huge here. For myself and Craig, the story was very big in Australia. But we didn't realise the global scale of the interest. So it was good. Three more days in Thailand. We got to go to Chiang Rai Hospital and see the kids in the ward the next day, Craig and I, which was brilliant. Fine. I mean, kids are so resilient. Yeah. They're all sitting in bed, munching into their food and...
pleased to see you.
Yeah, they were, but they were so busy eating they could barely look up the king's representative, who gave us a nice certificate and, you know, a few ceremonial sort of things. And then I thought, I can just come home, get back to work, and this will all be just a great adventure I can put behind me. But clearly that was never going to be the case, because the story just seemed to get bigger and bigger, and then the press really went to town in Australia. And
what did your family make of it all?
Well, they're very proud of me, I'm sure.
I bet your wife was a bit frightened during the study.
Yeah, she was. It was my physical danger, because she knew I'd be careful in the cave, and I was telling her that it was psychological impact on me if one of the kids had died, I think. So, and I'm glad I didn't have to put that to the test, because I don't know if I'd be robust enough to deal with that if it had all gone wrong.
And you've got three children,
right? Yeah, I've got three. Two boys and a girl.
How old are they?
22, 21 and 18.
And you're a fairly quiet guy yourself, as I understand, and this is all unexpected publicity for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
How are you coping with it?
Well, it hasn't been entirely welcome, I have to say. I don't really go out of my way to, pursue a media career, and I found it all pretty overwhelming to start with, but I am getting used to it. And, look, getting an award like the one I received from the Association here today, I found that quite emotional, because it's just being recognised, I think, by your peers for doing something like this is much more important to me than, you know, a medal from the government or you know, something nice in the newspaper. I'm very proud of the fact that I was an anaesthetist involved in it.